Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. If you haven't heard this yet, in the last few days, New York City and New York State have both now declared the monkeypox virus a public health emergency. Once the epicenter of the coronavirus pandemic and earlier of HIV/AIDS, New York City is now the epicenter of the monkeypox outbreak in this country. In the city, there's been a more than threefold increase in cases over the past 2 weeks, according to reporting from Gothamist, and this is likely an undercount because there remains a lack of testing capacity. So how does this public health emergency declaration change things? What's changed and what hasn't in the care that monkeypox patients are receiving? And how are public health officials messaging against the stigma while prioritizing care for the populations that have so far been disproportionately affected by the virus, queer men? With me now for an update on the monkeypox virus and the official public health response are Joseph Osmundson, a microbiologist, activist, and writer with a PhD in molecular biophysics, and author of the recently published Virology, Essays for the Living, the Dead, and the Small Things in Between. And we also have Jay Varma, physician and epidemiologist, director of the Cornell Center for Pandemic Prevention and Response, and professor of population health sciences at Weill Cornell Medicine. Hi, Dr. Osmundson, Dr. Varma, great to have you both back with us on WNYC.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Dr. Varma, so what does the public health emergency declaration actually change with respect to the response of both city and state governments?
Yeah, the reason a government does this is really basically for three reasons. And that's true both for here in New York City as well as at New York State. The first is it allows the city to expedite anything it needs related to staff, stuff, or space. So if they need to hire somebody quicker, they can bypass a lot of standard procedures and they can contract quickly for other services. The second thing it does is it allows either the Commissioner of Health or the mayor himself to issue an executive order that may, bypass existing law. So, like during COVID, for example, you saw that during, limiting hours or capacity at certain facilities. And the third thing it does is raise political awareness. It gets people like WNYC and other people to talk about monkeypox, which is really, absolutely critical in terms of raising awareness, both among people at risk as well as among medical providers.
Most known cases in the state, we should say, are in the five boroughs. So why then, Dr. Varma, did the state declare monkeypox a public health emergency before the city did?
Well, the city and state have, both different authorities as well as different, capacity to deal with certain issues. So, for example, the state, regulates hospitals and all healthcare facilities, like nursing homes. So there may be situations in which the state needs to have this declaration as well if it wants to issue specific guidance or requirements at that level. And the second issue is, of course, there's a lot of inequity in New York State itself. There's a lot of counties outside of New York City that have nowhere near the capacity to, deliver vaccines or conduct testing with outreach simply because they don't have the staff. And so this would allow the state to also help address those counties, which may have the absolute number of cases may be quite small, but it represents a large burden that their health department can't meet.
So listeners, we're going to open up the phones for your participation in this conversation about monkeypox, now officially declared a public health emergency at the New York City level and New York State level. First of all, if you've actually had monkeypox, you want to help us report this story by telling us what you've gone through or are going through or how you managed or are managing and how you cope with the stigma, if that's part of it for you, as well as the effects of the virus physically, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. I feel like a lot of the conversation in the media about monkeypox so far has been with public health officials and experts like our guests, and they obviously need to be on and impart their knowledge. But we also need to hear the voices of people who are experiencing this firsthand. We need to hear community voices. We need to hear individual voices. So if you've had monkeypox, or even if you know somebody who's had monkeypox, help us report this story tell us what you or the person you know has been going through. How did you manage the physical symptoms? Is there a stigma element that you want to talk about? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or tweet at Brian Lehrer. And beyond that, we can just take your monkeypox questions for Joseph Osmundson, again, a microbiologist, activist, and writer with a PhD in molecular biophysics, and Jay Varma, physician and epidemiologist, director of the Cornell Center for Pandemic Prevention and Response, and professor of population health sciences at Weill Cornell Medicine. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Your experiences and questions are invited. So, Dr. Osmundson, is the evidence still indicating that most monkeypox cases are spread by close personal skin-to-skin contact?
Yeah, that is absolutely right. And, you know, I am both a scientist and also a community member. So many people I know are dealing with monkeypox directly or have been exposed and have had to try to find vaccinations to prevent, hopefully, them getting the illness. And really, New York City and New York State are doing the right thing. But New York City and state cannot procure vaccine. They do not control the national stockpile. They are not the CDC that says how many pages of paperwork a physician has to fill out in order to get someone treatment. They really have no control in terms of regulating the tests for this virus. So we are really arguing that the federal government, who has sort of the most control in New York, but also nationwide, that they need to understand finally that this is a public health emergency, and that when the federal government follows New York City and state in that declaration, will hopefully open up new pathways to test and make treatment and hopefully also vaccination be so much easier, because on the ground, people are still not able to access treatment, and they are not able to access vaccination. And most spread, yes, is still occurring, we think, through very extended skin-to-skin personal contact. And, you know, it's, we can't ask people to not have skin-to-skin contact for weeks and months. People need the tools that the government has, actually, to keep them safer when they have that type of interaction.
Well, is there a kind of safe skin-to-skin contact or safer skin-to-skin contact in the context of monkeypox?
Of course, we are, you know, giving people all of the information that we can in terms of risk reduction and safer interactions, both sexual interactions and non-sexual interactions. You know, we're talking about, you know, at the circuit party, instead of going shirtless, maybe wear a shirt, you know, minimize how much skin you have available. You know, interacting with people sexually on a webcam is the safest way to interact. And then there's gradations all the way down to, you know, the most risky type of in-person interaction is with lots of people and lots of skin touching. So yes, we are asking people to be mindful of risk awareness around the behaviors that, you know, just like with COVID and with HIV, there are steps individuals can take. But we know based on public health that asking people to do those harm reduction steps over and over and over again, it's very limited, and people are beautifully imperfect. And we need tools and redundancies such that, you know, a human being's imperfection, it does not land them with a virus.
Let's take a phone call from Jack in Brooklyn, who says he recently recovered from a case. Hi, Jack. You're on WNYC. We really appreciate you calling in.
Hi, Brian. My pleasure. I think you're totally right in saying that hearing voices is important right now. I definitely experienced some excruciating pain, a bit of stigma even within my friend group, and I know that right now the largest piece of recovering and putting together a health plan has been a network of gay friends messaging about vaccine availability, messaging which doctors might be more helpful to get TPOXX medication. And so I'm really grateful for my social sphere, because it was incredibly painful. And, you know, I had to talk to a ton of different doctors about pain medication and sort of exactly what I was going through. There was sort of a different diagnosis going on, and it was just a really confusing time. And it seems like it sort of sprung up from nowhere, even though we have a lot of models to base things off of in recent history.
When you say different diagnoses going on, were you first diagnosed with something else and then you had to go to another doctor to confirm that it was monkeypox or something like that?
I know a number of my friends initially were told that perhaps they were experiencing a herpes outbreak. So they were prescribed things like Valtrex. And then, you know, overnight that sort of turned into a monkeypox diagnosis. Doctors saying, I think this might be herpes. Never mind, I think this sounds more like monkeypox.
Yeah. And when you talked about suffering some stigma, even in your friends group, can you talk, as it might be useful for people to hear, a little bit of how that played out?
Sure. It was just about sort of once I was in the clear, once, you know, doctors say, once lesions fall off, scab over, and you have new skin growth, you know, I personally only had one pock on my entire body. And once that went away, you know, I was able to go socialize and things, but I experienced some, maybe a bit of judgment in my re-entry to socialization, which was, you know, painful and confusing. I think that we need to do our best to educate, just like we had to do with COVID not so long ago, to make sure that we know the facts that doctors are putting out there, so that we can minimize all of that judgment and not make our friends feel any particular way about re-entering into social, you know, situations.
Jack, we really appreciate your voice. Thank you very much for calling on, and be well. Here's another caller who says he's just recovering from monkeypox, Ed in the Bronx. Ed, you're on WNYC. Thank you so much for calling in. Hi there.
Hi, how are you?
Good. How are you?
Finally recovering. It's been a rough 2 weeks. You know, partly because of the limited access or the difficulty in accessing the antiviral TPOX, which could have probably shortened my recovery. And it wasn't until I actually got the TPOX last week that I saw significant improvement within 36 hours. The severe pain that I was experiencing for some of the pox and the lesions had gone away. Had I gotten this much sooner, knowing that I was exposed to monkeypox and knowing that I have monkeypox, I think me and many people out there could have just gotten through this much quicker.
What was the cause for the delay in your case, if you can say? Was it that your doctor didn't know about it? Was it the supply wasn't available? Can you say?
Well, it's a combination of a lot of issues. It's a combination of, you know, this is something new for a lot of doctors, and a lot of doctors are not equipped. A lot of medical offices aren't equipped to handle the amount of paperwork that was required up until a little less than 2 weeks ago, when, you know, you can now do it at the back end instead of the front end to get someone approved with medication. So there were a lot of roadblocks. So this is just not having the capacity to dedicate so much time to fill out the paperwork. So we were relegated to offices that, you know, such like places like Callan Lord and Columbia University, where they do have the capacity to handle the paperwork, but at the same time, they were being flooded by people trying to get access to the medication. So there were delays left and right.
And
you know, another thing that I want to add is, you know, that the government really dropped the ball on this with, you know, we knew that the first cases were popping in May. Why did it take so long for them to begin to releasing significant amounts of the vaccine to the general population that was being impacted? We knew that was happening. And here we are now. So there's a lot of suffering, you know, from due to government neglect.
Ed, I appreciate your voice. Thank you very much for sharing your story and your critique of how the government has handled it as well. So, Dr. Varma, let me ask you about one of the things that the first caller said, and that was, well, actually, let me ask you about something that the second caller said about the 36-hour vast improvement time from the time that he was prescribed the medication. Is that your experience? Talk about the effectiveness of the particular medication? Are there multiple medications? What's the best course of treatment if somebody discovers that they have monkeypox?
Yeah, so Brian, thank you for raising that, and thank you to Ed and Jack for sharing their stories. You know, it takes a tremendous amount of courage to acknowledge the suffering you've been through, and we really appreciate that as public health people. The drug that your second caller was referencing, the chemical name is Tecovirimat, but the common name is TPOX. This is actually a really interesting story, and I'll tell it very quickly because it's relevant to the issue here, which is actually that the U.S. government in 2001, because it was concerned about the potential risk of a smallpox bioterrorism attack, kind of mobilized all parts of government, the NIH, the CDC, Department of Defense, to find a drug that could be used to treat smallpox, because there was never a drug discovered before for this. And they developed TPOX, which, because smallpox and monkeypox are very similar, works very well for monkeypox. Now, because of short-sightedness at that time, the U.S. government approved it only for the treatment of smallpox, even though it was demonstrated in their animal models to be very effective against monkeypox. And as a result, you know, CDC is as the only agency that can release the drug and is releasing it with all this paperwork required. And so many of us, Joe, myself, and tremendous community activists have worked to expedite that. We don't have a really good randomized trial, which is kind of the gold standard. You know, one group has monkeypox and gets the drug, another group has monkeypox and doesn't get the drug. But there's a lot of data from animal models and now from patient experience indicating first that the drug is safe, that it has very few side effects. Second of all, that you can see these kind of very dramatic reduction in pain and discomfort and rapid removal of these lesions very quickly. And that's particularly important, not just because it reduces suffering, but it also reduces the time that people need to isolate. So it's both good for the patient as well as good for us society, because it gets people out and about much faster. So we're hopeful that there's going to be both good research on this, but also really just expanded compassionate use.
And Dr. Osmundson, to one of the things the first caller was talking about, the wariness of his friends to interact in certain ways after he was recovered. Can you talk about the timeline of recovery and immunity? We know with coronavirus in general, once you've had it and in the immediate period after you've recovered from it, you're pretty safe to interact with other people, both for yourself and for them. What's the case with monkeypox?
Yeah, first, I want to echo Jay's comment about Ed and Jack. The thing that I heard from those callers was what we saw with HIV, what we're seeing again now, where a community is being impacted and they feel left behind and they become experts at their own health. You know, hearing Ed and Jack talk, I was hearing specific nods to changes in CDC protocols about TPOC, you know, that as an activist, we've been following, but patients have had to become experts at that level in order to advocate for care for themselves. And it gives me immense pride in my community, but it also makes me so scared and worried that not everyone has the time and capacity to have to do that to get a drug to ease their suffering. I have immense pride for my community at the moment. This is a really long isolation. As Dr. Varma said, folks need to isolate when they're infectious, and that can be for weeks. And so that's another thing that a public health emergency at the federal level can do, is mobilize funds to help people, support people, get the emotional, practical, and financial needs met so they can properly isolate to prevent ongoing spread. Once you're cleared by your doctor and you have that good skin grown underneath the lesions, you know, you are the most immune person in the North American continent to this virus, right? So it's like, in a way, you know, we had this framework shift around HIV in the last decade, where we learned through amazing science that someone who's HIV positive and undetectable actually is the safest sex partner in terms of HIV transmission. They cannot transmit HIV. Whereas if you think you're having sex with someone who's HIV negative, they might not know their status, et cetera. You know, so someone who has just recovered from monkeypox is sort of the most immune, quote unquote, sort of safest, the best.
Good to know. And is there a test to determine that somebody is clear? Is it like a negative COVID test?
There isn't, right? So we have a huge runway ahead of us in terms of diagnostics. The only diagnostics available now are on open lesions. And, you know, frankly, just because someone has the DNA in their saliva does not mean they're infectious. Again, this virus was ignored from 1970 until now. So these fundamental virological questions, is there live virus in saliva? Is there DNA in saliva? What is the pathway to recovery? What are the exact and the total? You know, we don't really understand if saliva and respiratory droplets play a significant role or not. And why do we not understand that? Because until recently, this virus impacted people in a place that we could ignore and forget about and think that it wouldn't impact us. And we could ignore also the suffering of the people in the endemic region. And we're seeing just the global cost of ignoring a preventable infectious disease anywhere on this planet.
Kevin in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hi, Kevin.
Hi. Yeah, I just had a question about how the vaccine eligibility criteria are slated to change under the emergency order. And just a comment on, I think, how restrictive that the criteria have been so far. I think currently you need to be a man who has sex with men with multiple sex partners in the past, I don't know, 2 weeks or something, to be eligible to receive a vaccine. And I feel like that's just a very ham-fisted policy decision that leads to some of the stigma that we're talking about, and really doesn't give me that much faith in the government's ability to make this epidemic different from what we saw with COVID.
Wow. Dr. Varma, do you want to confirm or refute those eligibility criteria as Kevin laid them out and comment?
Yeah. So first comment was about whether the eligibility criteria will change. I don't think they will for the near future. Really, right now, there's just simply not enough supply to meet the demand. So the priority at the federal government level, in addition to getting more supply, is to make sure it gets delivered to the people at highest risk. And we know right now that the highest risk group is, you know, gay men and people in their sexual networks. And that's sort of been loosely defined, you know, sort of, or written definition is sort of multiple or anonymous sex partners in the last 14 days. You know, I mean, I would say that you know, people are just self-attesting to what their risk is. I wouldn't encourage people to come out there and claim their, because it is unethical, you know, the claim that you're at higher risk than you are. But, you know, there is some nuance in what it means to be at risk. You know, what is the definition of multiple sex partners, for example? But right now it is really a priority that group maintain the priority for getting vaccinated. And then the only other group that's recommended to get vaccinated is people who are known close contacts. So let's say you're a household member of somebody who's in one of those high-risk groups and has gotten monkeypox.
A few more minutes with Dr. Varma and Dr. Osmundson on what it means that New York City and New York State have declared monkeypox an official public health emergency. And with your monkeypox questions and anecdotes generally, Alex in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Alex.
Hi there. Yeah, thanks for this conversation. It's been actually incredibly enlightening. I do have a question. Should gyms that do or athletic facilities that have like a lot of sports with close contact, like wrestling or jujitsu or any of those kind of sports, be taking monkeypox more seriously? I think for context, this isn't really being talked about or taken very seriously at all in those circles, and I'm kind of curious if it should be.
Dr. Varma, should it be?
You know, at this time, there isn't a, you know, the number of people with monkeypox, even though it has grown, you know, substantially, is not a level where I would say that, you know, all gyms need to be implementing, you know, immediate precautions, you know, related to monkeypox. Now, that said, you know, the caller is highlighting an important consideration, and this is very relevant for, you know, back to college and university settings as well, too. You know, we know that diseases that transmit by skin-to-skin contact, such as like MRSA, you know, a skin infection, you have outbreaks in places where people are in close contact, like gyms, wrestling teams, et cetera. So it wouldn't surprise me if there end up being some infections that end up getting transmitted through gyms and saunas and other places like that. And so I do think that gyms and saunas and places like that should be thinking about kind of what their protocols are going to be for the near future. You know, there's always a benefit to having enhanced cleaning of surfaces in those places, but I don't feel like there need to be specific warnings or business restrictions at this time on those places.
Related question from a listener on Twitter says, how long does the monkeypox virus live on surfaces like doorknobs or grocery packages and products or hotel linen? Dr. Varma, I'll stay with you for that. If it does even live on all of those surfaces that the tweeter referenced.
Yeah, so this is a important question we don't know the exact answer to, but I'll tell you what we do know, and then I'd be happy to see Joe, since he's a basic scientist and works on these viruses, maybe, you know, chime in as well. What we do know is that, you know, this virus can survive on the surfaces around a patient, and particularly on the clothing, towels, linens, et cetera, that a person uses. And this is based on epidemiologic investigations in Central and West Africa, where the disease has historically been localized to. But we don't know, because those studies were never done in sort of exhaustive detail, to figure out how long it survives. And it's particularly challenging, even if you can detect the virus on a surface, to know, is it actually infectious to other people? You know, a lot of people are asking the same questions, for example, about COVID. So the current recommendation is that, you know, any surfaces that you use in your home or any utensils should be washed thoroughly. You can use a dilute bleach, or you can use an alcohol-based solution, or even just vigorous scrubbing with hot soap and water. And that your linens and things should be washed in a washing machine. And if it's a proper washing machine, that should disinfect them. But we don't really know the answer whether it's hours or days that you're at risk of getting infection if none of those surfaces are cleaned.
Did you want to add anything, Dr. Edmondson?
Yeah, I do. You know, it's remarkable how little we know. You know, the pox viruses are robust viruses. They tend, you know, we know, unlike COVID, where we really thought fomite might play a role, and it turns out largely no. Here's a virus where epidemiologically we know that surfaces can play a role. You know, I mean, thinking about very early on in COVID, I think in March, a preprint came out on the SARS-CoV-2 virus, which was a novel virus. It did not exist on the planet before, you know, the 6 months prior to the pandemic, showing the durability of the virus on different surfaces for different amounts of time using really good virological methods. We still don't have that for this virus that's been described in humans since 1970. And I just cannot help but believe that's because largely the people impacted before now were in Central and West Africa, and the people largely being impacted now are queer men in our sexual network. You know, that the WHO said, the panel that recommended against declaring this a public health emergency of international concern, literally said, oh, it's just affecting gay men, and therefore it's not yet an emergency. You know, and before it was just affecting people in Central and West Africa, and therefore it's not an emergency. And this affects what virological questions we ask and answer. How has no one published the surface durability of this virus using best virological practice? It astonishes me, the lack of basic virological knowledge we have. And I cannot help but believe it's because of the communities largely impacted so far.
So lastly, Dr. Osmondson, let's talk about the public health messaging here for just a second. That is, so far, how are public health officials weighing the need for destigmatizing responses, and how do you recommend that they do, while also recognizing that certain groups have been disproportionately affected by monkeypox? Even the term men who have sex with men sounds sort of clunky, plus it could lead to some missed diagnoses because some trans and non-binary folks aren't really included in it. In fact, I'll also read a tweet that just came in from a listener who says to not forget that transgender, gender nonconforming, or gender non-binary people are also eligible for the monkeypox vaccine, not just men. But Dr. Osmondson, how do they strike the balance? How should they strike the balance?
Yeah, we're talking about behaviors and risk, not identities. So you'll notice Jay and I have not been saying men who have sex with men. We've been saying gay men or queer people and our sexual network, which better describes the lay of the land. When I open up Grindr on my phone, I don't just see men, right? I see people of different genders, and increasingly so. And that is something my community is really proud of, and I think we've been doing better on, and the public health community needs to catch up to where we're at and make sure that trans women and non-binary people know that they have access to vaccine. And when they go try to get vaccine, you know, that they do not have any issues in that line or with their healthcare provider. Look, the messaging here is so difficult. And we are in a world with increased institutional homophobia and transphobia. We see legislative pushbacks on our ability to exist in public in many places, you know, and so, but at the same time, my community's health is the first thing on my mind. And I'm not worried about not being honest with my community about different risk factors because of what some sort of a fascist Republican type pushback against queer people's ability to exist. We need to be very clear and honest and direct, you know, for community, by community. That's why I'm so glad we've heard from someone, you know, me and the other callers who are in the community affected. We need to be left to talk to our community about what's risk. And then the other thing is our government needs to show up because we have need. You know, people wanted to get vaccinated before Pride, and the federal government did not let that happen. You know, gay folks are not driving this epidemic. A global lack of access to healthcare is driving this epidemic. And we need to be very clear that gay sex is a thing that has always existed and will always exist. People deserve the tools to enjoy the type of sex that they like without risk of infectious disease. And we have those tools with this epidemic. And it is a crime that people have not been able to access those tools.
And I said that was going to be the last question, but some tweets have just come in that I want to reference because I think they're interesting and important. Someone writes, while vaccination appointments are extremely limited in New York City, neighboring county health departments have vaccine clinics with minimal waiting time. So if that's true, posted by somebody who's tweeting as fam doc, as in family doctor. That's good information for people. And Dr. Varma, one for you from a listener who asks,
Can I hop in on the previous question just really quick?
Yes, you may.
So that is true. We've seen Westchester County and places on Long Island have vaccine appointments when no one could get them in New York. The question is, who in New York City has the privilege, the access, the ability to take off work, to get up to Westchester, to pay for the Long Island Railroad, to pay for the cab to the county health place and to actually access that vaccine? So, you know, we know that that's true, but that really disproportionately helps a certain type of person.
Dr. Varma, listener writes, I am a licensed massage therapist in Manhattan. I am up to my elbows in multiple naked people 5 days a week. Why is the monkeypox vaccine not available to those in my profession?
Yeah, no, it's an important question because it also relates to why the monkeypox vaccine isn't being provided routinely to healthcare workers as well. You know, normally when we have a new infectious disease, when we have a new outbreak of a disease, healthcare workers are at high risk and they often get prioritized as well. And the reason is fundamentally because there just isn't enough supply. You know, if there was enough supply, then people who come into close skin-to-skin contact with, you know, potentially with monkeypox patients should be eligible. So fundamentally, it's a supply question. Then when you look at, okay, well, we have a limited supply, who do we prioritize it to? We have to go with what we know. And the reality is both here in the United States and globally, this outbreak is so tightly linked right now to gay men and their sexual health networks, as well as their household contacts, that is where the limited supply has to go.
So,
it's not just, but that's what we're left with.
So 10 seconds, how will we get to sufficient supply for everybody who wants one?
You know, it's going to take some time. This is a vaccine that is not grown very quickly, and the U.S. fell behind on it. So it's one of the reasons I would really push for people to also understand the purpose of screening, how to look at your skin, educate yourself, and also try to access testing whenever possible, because we're going to be in this for some time.
Jay Varma, physician and epidemiologist, director of the Cornell Center for Pandemic Prevention and Response, and professor of population health sciences at Weill Cornell Medicine, and Joseph Osmundson, microbiologist, activist, writer with a PhD in molecular biophysics. And wait, I'm going to find your book title again, because how could I let you go without one more time citing your book title? It's Virology, Essays for the Living, the Dead, and the Small Things in Between. Unforgettable. Doctors, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you very much.